Hi, my name is Adam Shulman, and I'm going to talk about atmospheric circulation of hot Jupiters, which are the close-in giant planets, maybe only about a tenth of an AU from their stars. And started working on this project fairly recently. Tristan Guyot suggested this a few months ago as a possible project, and my prior background is in Jovian atmospheric dynamics. So first thing I'm going to do is outline some of the ideas for why the circulation is important, either for observables, albedos and things like that, as well as evolution. Go into some basic dynamical considerations relevant for, in particular, HD 209458b, which is the transiting object. And I'm starting to do some numerical simulations, so I'll describe the model and a sample simulation. We're really just beginning, so that's mostly just illustrative, and go into some of the implications. So a large portion of this talk is going to be qualitative, because basically Tristan and I have been batting around ideas, and we haven't completely converged yet on what we think is important, but this will give a sense of where we are. So this shows kind of a cutaway slice of a hot Jupiter with the day side and the night side, and the receiving intense stellar radiation from this side, and it'll be radiating in infrared at various positions. And an important feature is that hot Jupiters are close enough to their stars that their interiors are expected to be tidally locked so that they'll be in synchronous rotation. For a tidal queue of order 10 to the 5, the spin-down time might be of order 10 to the 6 years. So that's quite a different regime than the case of real Jupiter, for example, where the spin-down time would be much, much longer. And that means that in the absence of winds, there will be an absolutely enormous day-night temperature difference. And the only way to mute that difference is for there to be winds or some other form of transport inside the interior from the day side to the night side. And the planet is so hot that near the photosphere, near the pressures of a bar or something, the radiative time scales are fairly short. And so even if the wind speeds are quite fast, a kilometer a second or faster, it's still quite likely that the temperature differences from the day side to the night side can be substantial, with higher temperature differences for slower wind speeds. This is just a rough estimate. Another possible issue of importance is where clouds form, and particularly whether they form on the day side, since that will affect the albedo and the depth to which stellar light penetrates. And the issue of whether they form on the day side, of course, depends on the circulation. And finally, there's in the distinction with actual, in the case of actual Jupiter, the intrinsic luminosity from these objects, the luminosity or the radiated flux that corresponds to actual cooling of the object, is similar to within a factor of 2 of the absolute heat absorbed and radiated. The object's cooling off, but its total radiated infrared is maybe 1.7 of the absorbed solar light. That's not the case with hot Jupiters. In the case of hot Jupiters, they're receiving maybe of order 10 to the 5 watts per square meter from their star, and the current evolution model suggests that their intrinsic luminosity is more like 10 watts per meter squared. So there's a discrepancy of 4 orders of magnitude. So this is a very different regime than actual Jupiter. And one of the reasons that that could be important is if there'll be an atmospheric heat engine, there'll be energy, kinetic energy generated in the atmosphere because of the heating. And if there's even a fairly small efficiency of, in order for kinetic energy to be created and dissipated, then that could still overwhelm the intrinsic luminosity. And so if kinetic energy is created in the atmosphere, and if there's a way of transporting that into the interior, it could be a zeroth order effect on the intrinsic luminosity. So I'll go into each of those in a little bit more detail later, but first what I'll do is just describe some of the sort of the dynamical regime that this planet is in. We've just heard its mass is about 0.7 Jupiter masses. Its radius is about 1.3 or 1.4 Jupiter radii, which is 10 to the 8 meters. Gravity is about the same as Earth, 10 meters per second squared. And it has an orbital period of 3.5 days, which is inferred to be its actual rotational period as well because of the synchronous rotation, the idea of synchronous rotation. So using these parameters, we can start to actually get a sense of the dynamical regime that this object is in. We know its rotation rate, and so we can estimate a Rossby number. A Rossby number is the ratio of the inertial forces in the momentum equation, the inertial forces to the Coriolis forces. And In the case, of course, we don't know what the wind speed is, but if you just, you know, choose an estimate of say between 100 and 1,000 meters per second, and plug in sort of large-scale circulations of order to the planetary size, and use the inferred rotation rate, then you get a Rossby number of maybe 0.03 to 0.3, which is in the same ballpark as that of Earth's atmosphere. So what this means is that this is in what's called by meteorologists a geostrophic regime. Basically, that the definition of that is that the important force balance is between Coriolis, horizontal Coriolis forces, and horizontal pressure gradient forces, and then the acceleration terms in the equation are of order 10%, or of order the Rossby number, that fraction of the Coriolis and pressure gradient terms. And there's a huge literature on geostrophic dynamics, and the fact that this is in probably in geostrophic balance allows us to invoke some of that other literature. There's another length called the Rhines scale, which is basically a scale that is set by the rate at which the rotation, the effective rotation, changes with latitude. Basically, like if you have a parcel of fluid near the equator and you shove it to the pole, it will tend to accelerate in order to conserve angular momentum. And there can be shear instabilities that limit the size of structures given their speeds. And the Rhines length for this, and this R here would be like roughly the planetary radius. This is again the wind speed and the rotation rate. And so the Rhines length for this case is about 10 to the 8 meters, so of order the size of the planet. In the case of Jupiter, which is a similar sized planet, the Rhines length is more like 10 to the 7 meters. In other words, for Jupiter, it's about a tenth of a planetary radius. And this is one of the key reasons that Jupiter has a whole bunch of zonal jets. Jupiter has roughly 10 zonal jets, precisely because the Rhines length, there are about 10 Rhines lengths fit across the planet. So this suggests to first order that that there probably will be a zonal nature to the flow, but not perhaps as strongly as in the case of Jupiter. The deformation radius is 10 to the 8 meters. Deformation radius is defined as basically, it's essentially the radius to which material, like if you initially start with material that is not in hydrostatic equilibrium and it sort of flows outward in order to, because of a horizontal pressure gradient, Coriolis forces will tend to spin it up, and you can end up getting a vortex or other structure which has a net pressure gradient that is balanced by Coriolis forces. So on a rotating planet, you know, when there's a pressure gradient, you don't automatically get infinite flow of material until there's no pressure gradient. Instead, you relax to a point where there's a finite pressure gradient, and there's structures of a particular size, and that is the deformation radius. So it's also of order of the size of the planet, which suggests that you could get, you know, one or two gyres across the planet, but probably, it wouldn't look quite the same as actual Jupiter, because in the case of Jupiter, this is also about a tenth the size of the planet. In terms of speeds, Tristan Gio has done a little calculation suggesting that the maximum wind speed is about 2,000 meters per second based on the idea that you have an atmosphere of a known thickness, perhaps from 100 bars below which it would be sort of a convecting interior that would be in, tidally locked, and that you can have winds under the idea that you can have winds in the atmosphere above that, but it'd be a maximum speed beyond which you would start to get shear instability. So if you increase the winds past about 2,000 meters a second, then assuming the interior models are right for the structure, then you'd exceed the shear instability criterion, and you'd start to basically have overturning, and you'd dump some of this kinetic energy into the interior. Sound speed, just for reference, is maybe about 2,400 meters a second. Of course, this depends on temperature. This is just a characteristic value. Actual speed, it's possible to do simple estimates based on overturning from sort of, for example, Hadley circulation, sort of an analogy to the Hadley circulation, and you can also do a scaling analysis on the actual dynamical equations, and you tend to get an estimate of about 1,000 meters a second, which is uncertain to within a factor of 2 or 3. But it suggests a couple of possible kind of regimes, one regime for a steady state, because basically what's happening is you're pumping in an absolutely enormous amount of potential energy into the atmosphere. That energy would be converted into kinetic energy, and then you have to do something with that kinetic energy in a steady state. And so one possibility is that you ram up against this criterion, you keep pumping up the kinetic energy more and more and more, and then you get to the point where you start having shear instabilities. And so the steady state in the atmosphere corresponds to generation of kinetic energy balanced by shear instability dumping that energy into the interior, which would turn it into heat, basically. Another possibility is simply that you directly advect some of the kinetic energy into the interior. That may also be possible that tides play a role here.
Just for reference, what's the period of Jupiter?
10 hours. So it's about, it's about a tenth, That's actually why these features are different. Basically the, if you were to use the same speed as Jupiter, this scale is about the same. And in fact, that this is 10 times less is what changes these values.
If you have a small Rossby number and substantial differential rotation in a plasma, don't you expect some kind of alpha squared Einhorn effect
Or I haven't really thought about the effect of the magnetic field. That could be quite important. But yeah, actually for real Jupiter, that hasn't been thought about too much either. I guess Dave's worked on it a little bit with Randy Kirk, but.
So that's true Jupiter.
I'm sorry. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
That's in the atmosphere, so it's not ionized. Yet, I mean,
it probably means that you do have a magnetic field.
Yeah.
But are you asking whether, in turn, that magnetic field is going to change everything that we see next?
Yeah.
That's less obvious. Because sometimes, magnetic field only grows to the point where it's fast to be.
I was more thinking of a dissipation process like an amoeba diffusion.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right, because that, typically when a magnetic field is dynamically important, the truncation of energy dissipation will be dictated by the Ohmic dissipation processes because they're faster than diffusion and so forth. But anyway.
Okay. Okay, so now I'm going to go into some of the, in more depth some of the issues I mentioned before that are of observational importance. First, the day-night temperature difference. This sort of illustrates why there may be a finite day-night temperature difference. This shows pressure in bars going from 0.01 to about 100 bars as a function of time scale. I've shown three time scales on here. And green is the radiative time scale. So basically the idea is just that the time to radiate from, given the temperatures that we expect, which are 1,000 Kelvin or more, the time to radiate from a slab of a particular mass is gets higher the deeper you go down, just simply because there's more mass. You know, in this regime, it's sort of roughly proportional to pressure. Of course, the temperature is increasing too. Just for very rough estimates, if you assume some characteristic zonal wind speed and meridional wind speed, then these might be sort of, just to give you a sense of what the zonal and meridional time scales are. And so the basic idea is that at pressures perhaps above 10 bars, or less than 10 bars, meaning higher altitudes than 10 bars, there can be a substantial day-night temperature difference simply because the radiation time scale was fast compared to the time to advect material from one side of the planet to the other. So if there is a finite day-night temperature difference, we heard in the last talk, and it's summarized also here, that this could be important for direct observations. Here's the star. The object can transits here, so we've seen it transiting. But also, you can see that the object is in various phases. So, well, first of all, you can just directly measure the albedo of the day-night phase, perhaps. But also, you may be able to measure day-night temperature differences. So this temperature difference may be observationally accessible sometime in the future. Also, it's possible, though we haven't yet worked out the details, that this is relevant for the evolution. Current evolution calculations assume, or they're kind of 1D in the sense that they assume kind of a homogeneous atmosphere with no day-night temperature differences. And a characteristic temperature profile that they might have is shown here in the green curve. So the idea is you have a convective interior, so this would be following an adiabat. Sort of a single entropy, characterizing this deep interior going down to the center. And then maybe from 1 to 100 bars, there's a radiative region, so that's statically stable to convection. And then in that region, the intrinsic luminosity is being transported, which is much, much less than the stellar absorbed. And there's some region where sunlight is absorbed and then radiated, then the infrared radiation from that sunlight is re-radiated. And so in this region, temperature profile is steeper, but it's also radiative. So the reason for this kink here is simply that the heat flux is low in this region and high here. And basically, if it were isothermal, that would be transporting zero heat flux by radiation. And if it's steep, it's transporting a large heat flux. And so this kink exists because of the kink in the radiated infrared heat flux, basically. People have done models to try to calculate this. But if there's a day-night temperature difference, then on the day side, which is drawn here in this red curve, you'd expect the day to be warmer, and so the in this region, the intrinsic luminosity will be lower because the heat, the temperature profile is closer to an isotherm. And on the night side, in blue, because the temperature profile is steeper, you'd expect the intrinsic luminosity to be greater. And it's not at all clear that when you sum these, the red curve and the blue curve up, that you get the same thing as the green curve. And so we need to work out exactly what you do get, but it's quite possible that this will be important for the long-term evolution.
What is the dominant process determining where the sunlight is absorbed? How do people decide where that is?
Somebody else should answer that rather than me, but the main issue we've been worrying about is whether there are clouds. That would probably make the distinction between sort of one or a half a bar versus three or four or five or 10 bars, but you may.
I mean, the presence of dust opacity, essentially, you know, that really governs where the depth, where the light is absorbed. In the absence of, if the dust is completely sorted out, then even the deepest layers down to low optical depths of 10 can be heated significantly. But if it's completely blanketed, like you saw in my talk yesterday, by dust, then all of it's going to be absorbed in regions above, way above tau equals 1.
What pressure do those correspond to?
In CGS, it's like 10 to minus 4.
10 to the 4, you mean?
10 to the 5 bars. Mm-hmm. But alkali absorbs a lot in the visible, so you have the strong shining.
I'm sorry.
The thing I was puzzling about is, of course, it's a completely different issue from what most people have been talking about here in terms of opacity, which is outgoing infrared. And of course, in the case of Jupiter, the sunlight gets down much deeper than the place from which the infrared energy escapes, right? That's a true statement.
Right. Jupiter itself. Yes,
I realize these objects are different, but it's a non-trivial question.
So clouds could be important, and circulation can affect the clouds. Here I show two possible scenarios, sort of conceptual models for what the circulation might do. And this is viewed sort of from the North Pole, sort of looking down. And so this circle here would be the equator with the sun over, the star over here. And in this scenario, you'd have a super rotation. So this would be a zonal flow around the equator, moving around the planet. And you'd have heating on the side with the star and cooling on the side away from the star. But if this flow is largely horizontal, if there's not a large vertical component, then this heating would be balanced by advecting this cool air in, heating it up, and then advecting it out the other side. So you could have a steady state. And if that were the case, then you would expect no clouds in this region. You may form clouds over here, but the idea would be, let's say you have a parcel of air over here that has a little bit of, you know, that where clouds have formed, and particularly if material is rained out, then you would have no more than the saturation value for the condensates. As that material advects over to this side, any clouds that existed would sublimate because this region might be a couple hundred Kelvin hotter. So you wouldn't have any clouds here. In this alternate scenario, it's sort of a kind of a Hadley cell or a Walker cell for those familiar with the terrestrial meteorology field. Basically an overturning circulation where air rises up under the point of heating, moves around the planet, and then descends on the night side. And it's possible here, although there are details, that you can get a cloud layer, because basically as you rise up, the temperature declines, and you carry condensable vapors from the deep interior, and you form a cloud. And so figuring out which one of these scenarios is right could be important for figuring out whether clouds exist.
Is the effect of the Coriolis acceleration known in those two scenarios?
In other words, what is the effect of the Coriolis acceleration? It looks like it's between one or the other.
Well, it's not necessarily. I mean, we certainly, you know, based on the idea that it's synchronously rotating, we know what the Coriolis acceleration is. And it certainly plays an important role in the dynamics. Probably this one would be favored by that, because in this case you can have a colder pole than an equator. Basically, like if you have eastward flow everywhere, then you have a Coriolis force both in both hemispheres that points toward the equator, and therefore you can have a pressure gradient force that points away from the equator, which means a hotter equator than a pole, and that makes more physical sense. So, and it's also possible that this, in addition to just affecting where you'd see clouds and what the albedo is, that this would affect the interior and possibly the radius. So I've just sort of schematically shown that here. This remains to be worked out. I don't really know that much about the details of these models yet. But basically what I show here is temperature versus pressure, and I show the two temperature profiles with clouds and without clouds. So the basic idea is, this is the, down here is the convective interior. This is the radiative region that's transporting the intrinsic luminosity, and this is the radiative region that's transporting the entire heat flux. And if you can get the sunlight down deeper, then you can extend the region of high heat flux down deeper, which means that the region with high temperature gradient is extended deeper, and therefore the model without clouds for a given sort of temperature up here, the model without clouds has a much hotter temperature in the atmosphere and in the interior by up to 1,000 Kelvin. So that might be relevant because it would affect the radius. Okay, so moving on to the possible idea of this dissipation being important. As I mentioned before, the total heat flux is of order 10 to the 5 watts per meter squared. Intrinsic heat flux, according to current models, is maybe about 10 watts per meter squared for an object of a few billion years old. On Earth, kinetic energy is generated at a rate that's about 1% of the convective heat flux. If this were the case also on hot Jupiters, then you'd expect about 10 to the 3 watts per meter squared kinetic energy generated in the atmosphere. And if you could get this into the interior, that would be 100 times greater than what people have been quoting as the intrinsic heat flux.
But it could also be infinitely greater because the intrinsic heat flux may be turned off.
Exactly, yes.
So in some sense, talking about ratios doesn't matter. It's the absolute number. And the 10 to the 3 is still small compared to 10 to the 5.
Sure, but the basic idea is that you can quench the cooling and reach a steady state early where you have a larger radius.
Yeah, but you can do that just by the solar luminosity.
What do you mean?
You turn off the reason. Why does Jupiter cool? It cools because the temperature corresponding to the internal adiabat at 1 bar is higher than the insulation temperature.
Mm-hmm.
If I took Jupiter right now and literally moved it in, you would turn off that heat flow.
Mm-hmm.
Almost completely, except for us. Tristan is expressing doubt, but there is, of course, a radiative term, I understand. But most of it is turned off because the deep interior is incapable of cooling efficiently.
I don't know what we have a cooling adiabat.
You don't have a cooling adiabat. That's precisely the point.
What do you mean by that term?
The reason why the planet is cooling at all is because it has heat that was placed there when it formed. That corresponds to some particular entropy. You then ask, in the presence of a sun or a star, is that entropy higher than what you would have at optical depth unity for re-radiation of the sunlight? If it is not, it won't cool at all. That's probably why Uranus has such a low heat flux, by the way. So the question of the intrinsic luminosity of a body is not independent of where it is. You can turn off that heat flow to move it. Not completely, of course. You still have a radiative contribution. But it's such a small, I guess what I'm getting at is I don't see why that's an issue at all in terms of what you're doing.
Surely
the issue is, what's the temperature difference between one side and the other, and that has to do with how you handle the heat flow from the sun, because that's so much bigger than anything else you care about.
If you put a 1% of the, that's exactly the point. I mean, the heat flux from the sun is so large that if you generate kinetic energy and dump even a small amount of that in the interior, that's a first order effect on the evolution that's been ignored.
I don't see why that's true. Why does it matter whether that's 10 to the 3 or 10 squared or 10? Suppose it were 10. The statement would still be true that you don't, because you're not going to have an intrinsic luminosity you can measure anyway.
It'll change
the luminosity of the body will be the re-radiated sunlight unless you had such a large intrinsic luminosity that it would be a measurable fraction of the total heat flux.
It changes the physics of the evolution, so it changes the radius.
Okay. Well, if you have,
I'm missing the point.
If you're in equilibrium and you have the center of your planet is hotter than the surface, and it's going to be the case, then you must have
an intrinsic heat flux because
Of course, but that is not carried by convection. Well, no, that's the point. So you can't get the center to cool at all, except to the extent that you carry heat by radiation. And if the radiative opacity is ridiculously high, which it is deep down, the system has no ability to lose the heat from deep down. Except, of course, as you get into the radiative zone, I understand that you can carry some, but you're going to shut most of it off.
Yeah, but what exactly what's happening is that you develop a radiative zone so that the entropy inside is allowed to decrease. Because otherwise, if you would stay convective, it would make no sense. Because you'd have a hot object inside with a cold surface and no heat, no flux, transported from the hot side to the hot center to the cold surface. So you need to develop that radiative region.
Maybe we're talking to class purposes. Yes, of course, what you just said is right. But my point is, what is the total energy coming out of the system in these circumstances? My point is that irrespective of whether you've got an intrinsic of 10 or 1,000 or 0.1, it's going to be very close to 10 to the power of 5.
That's true.
That's fundamental thermodynamics. And the fact that you're dissipating some of the energy makes no difference. Energy in is energy out, except for a tiny correction, which is small compared to your 10 to the 5, you're not going to be able to measure it.
No, it's not true, because if you're dissipating energy deeper down, then you're at a point, you're fixing the entropy there, at that point where the opacities are much higher, and so the object is not cooling as fast as it would if the energy was not dissipated.
Adam, are you or Tristan, are you going to tell me how much different is the total energy output as a consequence of what you're saying? My point is, it's not going to change.
It doesn't change. We're not saying it's going to change this. It's not going to make a difference in the temperature that you measure.
Right.
I mean, yeah, that's not the point. The point is that it affects the evolution, and it affects the radius after 3 billion years of evolution.
It affects the evolution because most of the energy inside the body is unable to escape. The inside is going to stay hot.
Yeah, that's the point.
And so you're not going to change the radius, and you're not changing.
Yeah, the radius is not decreasing as much. So if you don't.
Okay, maybe it's a qualitative question. Your point is.
For a fixed outer boundary condition, if you do have this radiative buffer, you're not going to jump on the same entropy profile in the convective zone as your wall.
I know. I understand that.
So, and then affects the convection.
No,
the evolution.
Yeah, I was never trying to suggest that it would change the surface temperature in a measurable way. Yeah, it's certainly not going to do that.
Because eventually, the adiabat is going to be jumping on at the bottom of your relative buffer is not going to be the same. It's going to be a cooler one as the one you would have got from a fully convective internal thermodynamics.
Yeah, all right. I guess I'd like to see the numbers. It just strikes me as a small effect.
We haven't done them yet. That's the task for this. That's the task for here.
It's not a completely negligible effect.
Oh, yeah, I agree. For the radiators, yeah, all right.
Okay, so it's still possible despite this. Sorry? It's still possible, even if it is this large, that it is negligible if it's dissipated in the layer where it was produced. So, if shear instability is locally, in the region where the sunlight is absorbed and the infrared radiation is radiated to space, if it's dissipated there, it's just a 1% perturbation to the absorbed and radiated. And in that case, it's irrelevant. The only way it would be relevant is if you can transport it down into the interior. And how far down is sort of a question that we need to answer. We haven't answered that yet. Possible mechanisms for getting energy down there are direct vertical advection of air that contains high kinetic energy, shear instabilities, and waves. Just to give an example of it's possible in general to force systems from one layer and have them build up kinetic energy in other regions. For example, on Earth, the oceans have currents, winds basically, that extend quite deep. You know, they're fast in the upper half kilometer and are non-negligible all the way down to the bottom of the ocean at 4 kilometers. And those are largely forced by winds at the surface, which of course are acting only in the uppermost tens of meters of the surface. This shows a little energetic diagram from data. This is from Peixoto and Ort, Physics of Climate. And this shows the what's called the available potential energy, which is that tiny fraction of the total potential energy that is capable of being converted into kinetic energy. This shows the kinetic energy. This is the total for the ocean system, averaged over the whole ocean. There's a small amount of flux, 0.002 watts per meter squared, put in by heating. This basically is baryclinicity. So this is when you change the density of, when you make dense regions even more dense, and when you make low density regions even less dense by heating, by changing the salinity, et cetera. This is just direct mechanical forcing by winds, increasing the kinetic energy. And it's about 4 times larger than this density effect. And then the energy is dissipated.
So it's surface waves, right?
Yeah. So it suggests that surface waves, which are, of course, acting over just a very thin boundary layer, are capable of pumping flows over a kilometer depth in the ocean. And actually, just as a side point here, people often say for Jupiter, well, if the winds extend deep, if Galileo measured deep winds to 20 bars or 100 bars, that means that they're pumped up by internal heat flux, whatever that means, rather than, say, solar energy forcing. But that's not necessarily true.
How deep is the Gulf Stream?
I'm not exactly sure, but I think it's like a half a kilometer, something like that. Also, if the Taylor-Proudman theorem suggests that there's a tendency for flows to extend deep. So the Taylor-Proudman theorem basically says that in a geostrophic system, if it is barotropic, meaning if basically contours of density and pressure line up, then flow is independent of depth, which and for a whole for a system like for a giant planet, that would imply depth basically in that case would mean parallel to the rotational axis. So if you force winds in some region, like the top, let me qualify that and I'll get back to that, then there would be a tendency for those flows to penetrate through a large portion of the planet. Of course, this would have to be modified by magnetic effects for winds that truly enter the magnetic area. By top, in this case, this does not necessarily mean that forcing in the cloud layer leads to deep winds, because that's a baryclinic region. This would mean probably the top of the convection zone, that's where it truly is barotropic, where it's essentially isentropic below that. So for example, if shear instabilities or some other process tends to dump energy into the top of the convection zone, then the dynamics tends to redistribute that energy along cylinders that extend through the planet. And the final point is just that once you have energy down there, that the tidal effects, of course, we don't really understand how tides actually damp out energy in planets, but most likely the tides would remove that energy. And so that would be a heat source.
Does the Taylor-Proudman theorem still hold under your conditions?
Well, it holds. It would not hold in the atmosphere because it's not barotropic there. But if it's isentropic in the center, then it would hold. And we have the extent to which that's true is still an open issue. But this, the Taylor-Proudman theorem is the argument often used to suggest that on Jupiter the wind may go through in cylinders, at least part of the way. I'm going to give an example. How much time do I have?
Gary Glatzerman's calculations about internal circulation of Jupiter show.
I'm sorry. Say again.
You know Gary Glatzmeier's calculations simulating flows in Jupiter? Three-dimensional global circulation model that's rapidly rotating stuff intended to try to model Jupiter.
Okay. Okay.
I don't remember anything about them except that they were done.
Okay, there were a couple.
They were done 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The Taylor-Proudman theorem is, of course, broken by magnetic fields. And Gary does not have magnetic fields yet in those calculations. And in this instance, if you got up to magnetostropic balance, you would certainly break Taylor-Proudman, just as we think it is broken in the Earth's core.
Okay.
But you don't see it in the sun either, the convection zone. So the convection zone in the sun, the contours.
The sun is at Rossby number 1 to 10, so it's a completely different regime. So you wouldn't expect to see Taylor-Proudman in the sun anyway.
People live for a long time.
Yeah.
I'm going to show just one example from the Earth. This is just an illustration of how waves can affect kinetic energy redistribution in the atmosphere. This basically shows a time series of an oscillation in the Earth's atmosphere called the quasi-biennial oscillation. And what this is height here. So this entire slice is in the stratosphere. This is 100 millibars, which is about maybe 10, 15 kilometers altitude or so, going up to about 10 millibars. It's the same for all these plots. And then this axis is time, starting in 1953, going up to 1985. And the plotted quantity is an average around the whole equatorial region of the east-west wind. And so these contours correspond to the strength of that wind. And this is sort of a bizarre meteorological convention. W refers to westerlies, which is an eastward wind, whereas E refers to easterlies, which is a westward wind. But basically, you can see these. I always thought it was confusing. But anyway, so if you look at any given year, like 1954, for example, if you looked at a time slice, you'd see there would be eastward winds in this portion. And then if you went a little higher, there'd be a region of westward winds, and then up here, eastward winds again. And that whole pattern moves downward over time. And the reason it does so is because of absorption of waves that are created in the troposphere and propagate up. And in the Earth's atmosphere, the main reason for wave, the main location in which waves are produced is in the troposphere. And of course, they're not going to propagate down into the interior, to the surface. But in the case of a hot Jupiter or a giant planet, that's not necessarily true. You could have you can imagine an isolated region, confined somewhere near where the sunlight is absorbed and where the infrared is radiated, in which there's kinetic energy generation, waves are produced, and those could, in theory, propagate both upward and downward and lead to acceleration of the flow, both in the stratosphere and at deeper levels. So this is basically waves can interact with the mean flow and accelerate it. That's the point there. Okay, so I did just a simple calculation, which really at this stage should be thought of as a toy calculation. The model that I used is called the Explicit Planetary Isentropic Coordinate Model. It's basically an atmospheric circulation model written by Tim Dowling. And I applied it to hot Jupiters. So what I did is I assumed that they're synchronously rotating. I used the parameters I mentioned before for HD209458b. I assumed an isentropic interior. Solved the equations of meteorology, and I did this over the whole sphere. Vertical coordinate runs from 0.01 to 100 bars. Used this resolution, fairly low resolution. And I parameterized the heating using a Newtonian cooling, which is just a linear relaxation from some assumed radiative equilibrium temperature to, or from the actual temperature to some assumed radiative equilibrium temperature, and I assumed a day-night difference in that radiative equilibrium temperature. So this heating is producing available potential energy, and then that the simulation, as the flow evolves, kinetic energy is converted.
Are the primitive equations in meteorology based on Navier-Stokes?
Yeah, they're Navier-Stokes, basically, and they're filtered to remove gravity waves because, or not gravity waves, but sound waves, because sound waves are not so relevant for meteorology, at least for the Earth. And this model comes from a tradition of Earth models. Okay, so what I'm showing here is three slices at three different vertical levels of the model, which occur at these approximate pressures, 0.4, 6, and 100 bars. And I'm showing the whole planet from pole to pole and on all longitudes. And the color that's plotted is pressure on an isentrope. And basically, this is the stably stratified radiative region. And so in the hot region is where the pressure is higher. So this isentrope is bowing downward into the interior, and that means this is if you were to plot temperature on an isobar, this would be a hot region.
So zero longitude is a subsolar.
Yes, so the heating is centered right around here. So this is the subsolar point right there, and the antisolar point is on this side. Then the arrows show the zonal wind. You can see that what happens, this is about 460 days into the simulation, and you can see that there's developed an equatorial super rotation that extends around the planet at all these different levels. There is a kind of this thermal bulge, and there's a hint of flow around it, which is actually what you'd expect from geostrophic balance, because isobars are roughly parallel, not exactly, but they're approximately parallel to these color contours on here.
I want to make sure the convection is differing, right?
Yeah, this model has no convection. Okay. This is just pure adiabatic flow in a stably stratified region. And the peak wind speed is up to 2 kilometers a second in this region, although the mean, if the mass-weighted mean is lower, it might be about 300 meters a second. So it's quite fast. It's lower down here. So, and there's energy. Now what I'm going to show is vertical velocity in, and it's the same three levels. The colors are the vertical velocity. Arrows are exactly the same as they were in the preceding plot. And positive regions are upward motion, and negative regions are positive regions. Like these hot regions are upward motion, and these blackish regions are downward motion. And this boundary corresponds to the interface between the radiative zone and the convective interior in this model. And so what this implies is that there's exchange across that boundary. And so some material is advected. So in this region, air with no kinetic energy is advected into the from the interior into the atmosphere. In this region, air with high kinetic energy is advected from the atmosphere into the interior. And so there's Well, it's not really it's not a convective plume. It's like it's a large scale overturning circulation. You could think of it that way. Although,
what are the amplitudes here, the magnitudes?
It's pretty low. I'm not exactly sure, but it's probably the equivalent of like a few meters a second or something, which is fast for the Earth, but it's much, much smaller than the horizontal velocities. So just to give a sense of the energetics, so here's the mass-weighted speed. It starts at zero, and then it hops up rapidly, and then finally reaches a steady state, or what I hope is a steady state. This shows the power per area, which is advected from the atmosphere into the interior, and starts at zero, of course, and then peaks at about 2,500 watts per meter squared. So this is the same order of magnitude that I mentioned before. And of course, this is a simple model at this stage, so it's not yet, we can't yet exactly say, okay, that's the energy, it's automatically, you know, deep enough that it will be dissipated. We still need to look at that in more detail. But at least as far as this sort of toy model has suggested, the possibility that dissipation is relevant for the evolution still seems like a tentatively good idea. So just Mark Molly gave me this. I'm just going to finish up with just to point out, this is Jupiter in the visible and in the 5-micron region, which is a spectral window. And there are these 5-micron hot spots, and not necessarily as much for hot Jupiters, but certainly for these objects in general. As we heard a little bit yesterday, it may be possible, or you know, the possibility of weather could be relevant for certain regions of the spectrum. For example, in the case of Jupiter, there's about 10 of these little spots centered around the equator, and if you add them all up, they only cover maybe between a tenth and a half of a percent of Jupiter's area, depending on how you define them. But they dominate the entire planet's flux in the 5-micron window. That's a small fraction of the total thermal heat flux. But if you're looking in that window, then you would never understand Jupiter unless you did not understand these objects. And so it's possible that we'll be seeing weather on extrasolar planets and brown dwarfs that you would need dynamics to understand, just from their spectra, even if you don't have images. Okay, so just to conclude here, the circulation would mute the day-night thermal contrast, but it could well still be substantial, and we think this will probably affect the evolution in ways yet to be worked out. The circulation also controls where clouds form, which determines the albedo and the depth of starlight absorption, and both of these are going to affect the evolution. And also, our calculations tentatively suggest that you can get of order 10 to the 3 watts per meter squared of kinetic energy, and if you can get this into the interior, then this would imply a dissipative heat source of about 10 to the 20 watts. And Bodenheimer et al. Have a preprint where in a different context they were interested in the effect of heating on these hot Jupiters, and they were sort of took the idea, well, maybe if you started with an eccentric orbit and you had tidal damping to make the orbit circular, that damping would be basically friction inside the planet that would dump the orbital energy into the planet's center, and that perhaps could act as a heat source that would puff up the radius. This was prompted partly by the idea that current evolution models are under-predicting the radii of some of these objects, although that's it's not 100% sure whether that's true or not. But anyway, so they calculated that for this heating of this order of magnitude, HD 209458b's radius could be puffed up by about 0.4 Jupiter radii. So this might be an important effect. Thanks.
It looks like your model is naturally selecting the tertiary alternatives circulation pattern.
Uh-huh. It Maybe, well, yeah, it could be. Let's see, is there...
Is there any way to induce the second?
Well, I think maybe. I mean, when this actually, when the calculations start out, they actually start out with a region that kind of has a overturning circulation over part of the planet with a zonal flow kind of extending around it, basically. And you sort of need some of those to still allow the equator to pull temperature gradient to, you know, have basically a decreasing temperature with latitude. If you purely just had this Walker circulation, you know, or if it were, you know, like if it were extending all the way to the pole, in other words, if there are regions of westward flow extending all the way to the poles, then you'd expect those regions to have a higher temperature at the pole than at the equator, which is a little weird. But one of the key issues, though, is whether the whether the heating is balanced by horizontal or by vertical advection. And that's sort of the more key issue in terms of distinguishing the two scenarios. And so in the first scenario, let's say this is pressure going down and this is longitude. So in the first scenario, the air is just going exactly horizontally, and there's some region of heating. And so the idea is that as this air shoots across exactly horizontally, it heats up, and then it cools off on the other side of the planet. And the idea is this would be like the subsolar point. And the other idea, basically, air, the heating is balanced by vertical advection. And I sort of drew it as this Walker circulation. But it's also possible that you could have vertical advection be important in this one, too. For example, a couple alternatives are exactly horizontal or going up and then down. Or, well, actually, it would be phase shift a little bit. So go up in the region of heating and then down in the region of cooling, like that. Or maybe just from some quirk of dynamics, it could go the other way. And this is important for where clouds form, because you'd get some sort of effectively like a mountain cloud right here, basically, with the wind flowing through it. So, and we still have to figure out exactly, you know, explore all the parameters and figure out which one of these is preferred.
Make a comment about the statement about Bodenheimer.
Okay.
I now understand what my confusion was.
Okay.
And it had to do with the word evolution.
Okay.
I have no problem with that statement.
Uh-huh.
The problem with the word evolution in my mind is that I thought it meant that there was something different about the deep interior. I mean, the really deep interior of the body. The answer is no.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this has to do with the outer region. And of course, you can pop up the outer region, but you're not going to change the region at 1 megabar. That's the point. And in that sense, there's no change in the evolution of most of the mass. That's my point.
Okay.
But now let me ask a different question. On this business of, and Stan Peel may be able to make a comment on this, on this business of synchronization,
mm-hmm.
What does it actually mean for a body that, of course, has no permanent bulge? I mean, the way one normally thinks about tidal synchronization is that, in the case of a solid body, you de-spin, and we all understand how the de-spinning happens, but then it finally locks into some particular orientation,
mm-hmm.
because there's some fossil bulge. Now, of course, these objects don't have fossil bulges. So presumably, what one means by tidal synchronization cannot be just simply stated that some particular aspect of the planet is pointing towards the star.
Yeah.
That's uh-huh. impossible, because there is no such structure within your object that does that.
Yeah.
So one has to be a little bit careful, I suspect, in defining the reference state with respect to which these winds move. Do you actually get tidal synchronization? What does that really mean?
If there's any eccentricity, no, of course, it will not be synchronic.
If it's an eccentric orbit,
yeah, sure.
it doesn't
uh-huh.
happen at all.
Yeah. Actually, that's an interesting issue.
Probably the eccentricity is damp, and I would expect you would come to some sort of mean that's pretty close to the synchronous rotation in the deep interior.
But for the eccentricity, it's sure damped, because we know of binary stars that are that close, and if they have a zero.
That's the only clue is what the Q is for stars, the damping of the eccentricity of binary stars.
But you understand that it affects your calculations, because you're implicitly assuming that the sun stayed at greater depth, which is at rest relative to this co-rotating, not true to synchronous.
Yeah.
And the question is that actually true?
Yeah, although if it were, let's say it were like plus or minus a
difference,
if it were plus or minus a meter a second or something, that would not be that big a deal. And
so it would have to be large to matter, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, it seems like another sort of sub-point on this issue you brought up is how do you define Jupiter's state of rest, quote-unquote, even though you're not with respect to a tidal bulge, but just in general. I mean, usually people, when they talk about System 3, they use the magnetic field. Yeah.
Rest, right? Because the magnetic field does not like differential rotation. So
I wonder if that would also be relevant for hot Jupiters.
A comment about magnetic fields, I just did the arithmetic. For a 1,000-kilometer length scale, which is relevant, 1,000 meters per second, you only need a conductivity 8 orders of magnitude less than a metal, okay? So sort of 10 to the minus 6 ionization or something like that.
Uh-huh.
So couple the magnetic field to your flows.
Okay.
So you can do it with very low conductivity.
Okay, is that
very low ionization?
But the point is, for these guys, if you have dust formation, then the degree of ionization is going to drop like crazy. So then you may lose your.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, 2,000 Kelvin, it's a question of which temperature.
Absolutely.
I agree, you may be right further up, but at 2,000 Kelvin, it'll be certainly conductive.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a question about in your simulation, in this very nice 3D. Or whatever, the dissipation occurs through kind of terminal viscosity, right?
No, well, we have a hyperviscosity, which is intended to be for numerical stability. And so we're actually not dissipating very much kinetic energy with that. And the steady state is, it's not a closed system. We're advecting material in some regions into the bottom and advecting it out in other regions. And the air we advect in has lower kinetic energy than the air we advect out.
Yeah, but the point I want to make is, basically, the Reynolds number, or the Rayleigh number in simulations, is fixed by your grid size.
Uh-huh.
So how do your results depend on the grid size?
I've done one simulation at double this resolution, and it looked fairly similar, but I haven't actually done a lot of diagnostics yet. But it's certainly something to look at. Yeah, I agree. This is actually lower than I was hoping to use. I basically did this because, on the computer I was using, the simulations took a long time, so but ideally, when we actually write up a paper or something, we'll probably at least double it and certainly check the sensitivity.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're quaking is something with extraordinarily high velocities, at least for me.
Uh-huh.
2 kilometers a second.
Uh-huh.
And I interpret that to be going on a fairly long length scale. Right.
That's right.
Right. And my question, I think, is related to the previous one, and that is, there you had energy transport on a very large scale.
Mm-hmm.
We know that in these non-linear systems, ordinary sort of chaos and so forth, that you can get these processes that rapidly cascade the energy down to the spine at the final scale. It all has to do with the issue of the role of fluctuations. And that's my question. In this kind of approach, how do you take into account the effect of the notable fluctuations?
The standard dogma for two-dimensional flows, and this is largely a two-dimensional system because its aspect ratio is very small. So I'm doing the whole planet, but a layer 1,000 kilometers thick. And also, even more than that, the vertical velocities are highly suppressed because it's statically stable, so there's no free convection. And in those systems, kinetic energy cascades from small to large length scales. And so in 2D, pure 2D simulations, Navier-Stokes, which are confined into a 2D plane, you tend to find, you may well know, you find that you actually get large coherent structures from small-scale turbulence. That's actually relevant for Jupiter. People often, in the case of Jupiter, put in, on purpose, small-scale fluctuations. They're supposed to be kind of a crude model of thunderstorms or other small-scale fluctuations, and they simulate how those evolve up into the Great Red Spot and other observed features. In this simulation, that's not really happening. It could be that it's relevant if there's local patches of small-scale convective events or something which are not included right now. But the forcing that I have in here right now is actually quite large scale. It's the hemispherical scale because of the day-night temperature difference that I've imposed. But there are numerical artifacts that are very small-scale fluctuations, basically numerical instabilities that tend to be grid-scale noise, and we have a hyperviscosity to damp those out.
there is a fundamental unsolved problem. Let's take Jupiter as an example. If you thought that the winds of the atmosphere extended down into the interior along cylindrical surfaces, which is what some people actually believe, so that you would have an enormous amount of kinetic energy at depth, because the material down below is much denser than in the atmosphere, you have this immense flywheel. If you calculate the kinetic energy in that, it's enough to drive the luminosity of Jupiter for very long periods of time. The system, apparently, is highly non-dissipative. That is, this is all based on the conjecture, of course, that we don't know is necessarily true. But if it were so, that you have these counter-rotating cylinders at great depth, they have to be highly non-dissipative. Otherwise, you get nonsense. You get the wrong heat flow and so forth. So this is a very interesting question there about how that system actually functions, and nobody's been able to figure that out. To put it more fundamentally, nobody understands where these zonal flows come from if they are, in fact, generated at depth. That's a basic unsolved problem. A lot of the numerical work in this area, in my opinion, is a long way away from addressing this question, because they tend to have vertical motions that are not that much smaller than the zonal motions. The suspicion is that in a body like Jupiter, that ratio is actually much, much less than one. Vertical motions in deep interior are thought to be 1 centimeter per second. Horizontal motions, zonal flows, east-west flows might be 100 meters per second. For what is the magnitude of it?
You have two counter-rotating cylinders, like in a quake.
It's not as simple as a quake. Well, yes, it's geometrically like a quake system, but that's necessarily satisfy the same stability criteria.
This is a final point here, a question on Saturn and Neptune. The observed winds approach 500 meters a second, so it's, you know, quite a bit larger than on Earth. And Earth's atmosphere, the mean, like, averaged over the whole area, the mean winds are about 17 meters a second. So it's not as high as what we're simulating here, but it's still getting up there.
They're getting up to molecular speeds, aren't
they? Yeah, in the case of Neptune, the Mach number is maybe 0.8 or something.
I have a comment to relate that thought to the previous one, and it's that those models may well be testable directly in the very near future. For example, you've seen that in the simulations, because of this zonal flow, you have a displacement of the hot point. It's not at the subsolar point, so it's displaced. And so if you look at the phase function of the planet as it rotates around the star, you should see if the hot point is connected to a different albedo in the visible, you should see that the phase function is not symmetrical. So that's something that should be testable in the near future. And of course, with transit spectroscopy, then you want to say something about temperature.
That also means you have a thermal time. Yeah,
it's another problem.
Yeah, I know, we've been worrying about that. I mean, you can think of the actual bulge, even if there are no winds, you can sort of think of that as a stationary thermal tide.
Okay. I guess closed the second.